You're listening to the Gold Squadron Podcast, your home for X-Wing discussion, strategy, and entertainment.
Episode 19 of the Gold Squadron Podcast is here. Thank you for joining us today, everybody. We have a jam-packed show for you today. I am joined by Gold Leader, Mr. Ron Longhi.
Hello, everybody.
Our targeting coordinator, Andrea Longhi.
Hey, guys.
Our North American champion, Marcel Manzano.
I don't like that title. Give me a new one.
Too high
expectations.
Okay.
Win Worlds, then you'll get a new title.
Okay.
I'm the Ewok.
Our friendly neighborhood Ewok, Marcel Manzano.
Booyagasha.
And our historian and flavor judge, Mr. Alex Maring.
Hey, everybody.
All right, so on today's show, we're going to be talking about opening setups and our prediction on the Wave 10's effect on the meta. Now, the reason we have to talk about that is our regional is happening 2 days after the Wave 10 is being released. We were informed by FFG that, yes, they are legal. Good luck, basically. So we'll talk about that more later. That's going to be interesting.
Yeah. The S is hitting the F.
All right. But before that, let's do a quick Patreon update. This month, if you're aware, if you look at the calendar, all of our patrons, there are going to be 3 episodes in this month just because 3 every other Mondays fit with our recording schedule. And since we're going to be having a little bit extra money coming in, I figured we do an extra raffle in January to show our appreciation for our patrons. So we're going to be giving away a Sabine's TIE Fighter or a Quad Jumper to whoever wins the raffle. They can have their choice of either of the ships. And the winner is Clayton Webb of Alexandria, Virginia. So shoot me a message through Facebook or email us, and we will get you that ship ASAP.
How do I get my name in the raffle?
You know how like in raffles they have that like big information at the end where all the people who don't qualify.
We're in the fine print.
Yeah, you're in the fine print.
All right.
Unlock the hologram.
So in today's installment of the How to Practice X-Wing series, we're going to be discussing opening setups. Before we go too far, it is my opinion that to really get the most out of our segment today, you're going to want to go back and listen to episode 17 about ship movement and episode 16 about obstacles, if you haven't already, or at least have a really good understanding of using those things in your playing. So we'll start by explaining what we're talking about when we say opening setups. We're talking about where and how you put your ships down on the table at the start of a match, and then once that is done, having a maneuvering plan from that setup. Now, planning these setups can get extremely in-depth depending on how many variations you want to plan for, but it's important that whatever plan you do come up with, that it's something that you can remember, because having a complex plan that you can't remember doesn't help you. And make sure that it's repeatable. You know, use the tools that you have, your range rulers, your movement templates to set that up. Now, these are some general rules of thumb when planning opening setups.
Wait, I got one more.
Go for it.
Make sure your double arc ships are facing the right way.
Yeah. And make it.
Oh, my God.
You laugh now. It actually happened 3 times.
Mind games.
Yeah, it happened 3 times, and they told me about it twice.
Oh. 3 times to you?
Yeah, I did it 3 times, and then twice they told me about it, and the next time they did it.
Now let's get into planning these opening setups. Ron, tell us about your process for creating opening setups.
Well, the first process that I do before I place any ships down is basically I just want to look over my list and my opponent's list and notice any strength or weaknesses in that matchup. If I don't know what my opponent's trying to do, wherever I place my ships won't matter. So things that I look for are which list seems more maneuverable, mine or my opponent's? Whose list has the pilot skill advantage? And then a simple thing is, there something my list, my opponent's list is trying to do that can be very easily negated by fighting in a certain area of the map? An example of that would be a Phantom. A Phantom needs room to maneuver and do its barrel rolls, so if you can fight the Phantom in a corner of the map, you really limit its maneuvering options and have a greater chance of getting it an arc. Once you mentally evaluate both of your lists, I like to ask myself a lot of questions. The first one is formulating my plan. How am I going to win this match? Am I going to have a hard time killing a specific target? Do I need to pick my target priority and go after a single ship first? Where on the map is the best place for me to engage? Do I want to engage in a wide open area? Do I want to engage on the edge of the map, in a corner of the map? Or do I want to engage in an asteroid or debris field? How do I force my opponent to fight where I desire? That actually really comes down to your setup, and we'll explain that later. Is it beneficial for me to joust my opponent and just focus on a single threat? Or do I want to come in out of formation and try to flank or maybe try to kite my opponent? Do I want my opponent to fly through obstacles to get to me? Do I need to fortress in the engagement so I can fight in an area that's more beneficial to me? Do I need to form a kill box? Does my opponent's ship so maneuverable that if I fly in formation, he can just boost or barrel roll out of my arcs if I fly in a formation? So I need to make a kill box instead and spread out so he can't do that or limit him. And then lastly, is there a ship in my list that's very maneuverable? Maybe I want to kite my opponent. Those are all the things that I think about before I place, which, like you said, it can be pretty complicated.
The good news is, though, these are all things that you can think about before coming to an event, particularly a big event. And that's one of the things we always encourage new players to do, is pick a list that they're going to be comfortable flying for a while. Because when you really know the ins and outs of a list, and all you have to worry about is how it deals with or interacts with your opponent's list, it will make you a much better player quicker, because you're only dealing with the one variable of your opponent's list. And then you can just really improve some of these skills, and it will become a little bit more natural for you to think about all of these things. And then you can start tweaking your own list or flying different things, but it will just help you as a newer player to fly the same thing, tried and true, week in and week out, until your this type of thinking becomes second nature to you.
Yeah, and actually, it does seem like that is a lot of complicated things, but when I'm placing my ships, everything that I mentioned, all those questions, can actually be executed usually from one or two basic setups. In each of those setups, I practice meticulously. I measure them using all the legal like range rulers and components that I'm allowed. And I also want to make sure that none of those maneuvers will bump. Basically, there's going to be two setups for me. Well, three, potentially. There's going to be flying my ships in formation, and I will have options to fly them with a slow approach, a medium approach, or a fast approach based on what my opponent's doing. And then I'll also have a fortressing option, which I don't do a lot of fortressing, but if you're flying a list with low pilot skill that isn't as maneuverable, and your opponents are flying a bunch of aces, sometimes you'll need to fortress to force those aces to fight in an area where you can actually get them shots. The other option is to fly out of formation.
Okay, can I stop you there real quick, Ron?
Yeah.
And I want to just take a step back. When we talk about the fortress part, you make your opponent get out of that corner, because a lot of the aces, right, they're going to maybe have two or three ships.
Yep.
And if you have four or five generic ships, you're going to have more red dice. And if they want to just go to the time and have it be final salvo, they're at risk, because they'll have less dice than you do.
Oh, absolutely. And I can tell you that when I was in Worlds, My biggest single handicap that I didn't practice for was I didn't have a fortress setup in my formation build that I felt comfortable just throwing in a world's tournament, so I just didn't do it. And when I flew up against Benjamin Lee in the last round of the Swiss to have a shot at the cut for top 16, he gutted me with his two high pilot skill 7 and 9 ships with boost and barrel roll, simply because he made me commit to a direction before the engagement, and once I committed, he was able to go around me. But if I had a fortress, I could have forced him to start moving towards me at some point, because I had far more dice. If you're flying in a formation, or you're flying out of a formation, I think it's important to have those options available to you. Basically, you want to have a slow roll option. So if you're, say you're flying against another, say you're flying against a ship, a bunch of ships that you know are real fast, like IG-2000s or something, you want to approach slow so they can't just jam you right at the start of the turn and just get a great range 3 shot on you. Or you want to have a medium approach if you think that you want to shoot someone at a closer range. You might want to approach at a medium pace so that that first engagement, you're just out of range 3 and no one can attack, so that on the second engagement is going to be your true engagement, where then you can start tracking at range 1 or 2 on that first pass, that first joust. Or you want a fast engagement for maybe you see your opponent, they make a mistake, they separate their ships, and you realize, oh man, if I just go fast, I can get all of my ships to shoot at one of his ships before his other ship can get in the engagement. It doesn't happen that often, but you want to be prepared for it in case they make a mistake. The only other thing I think about is which ships do I want in front, which ships do I want in back, and that's really if I want to protect a key ship of mine. Like, for instance, if I'm playing, say, a ship like Poe Dameron, and my opponent's playing a BTL Y-Wing, I really don't want Poe ever to get double-stressed, or say I'm playing Suter, I don't want him getting double-stressed. So I want to keep that ship back, and I can use my front row of ships to protect that back ship. And there's a lot of other examples, but those are pretty much everything that I do when I get to a game, and 90% of this is done before I've even get to the table, which is really important.
Yeah, and another thing just to add on to, like, which ships you want in front, so to speak, which just speaks to the general formation in which you place your ships. We've talked about this in the past, but you always want to keep in consideration that you probably want the higher pilot skill ships in the back anyway, unless you have some turn formations right out the get-go that are part of your plan, because those ships, if they end up in front, just makes it that much harder for you to correctly maneuver your ships, because you'll have to mark everything. If the lower PS ships are in the back and you have to mark the higher PS ones in the front, it just leaves more room for human error for you to mark that ship, move your other ship, have to put that other ship back, and it makes it much easier for you to make a mistake when you're having to mark all of those things, and then you can create potential bumps, or you could end up overlapping something that you didn't think you should have overlapped, because when you're practicing and when you're working through some of your potential opening setups, it's a big advantage to know that you can just clear an asteroid or just clear all of your ships without bumping, because your opponent might not think you can. But if you've practiced it, you know you can. But again, you just want to make sure that you're not creating more opportunities for human error.
All right. Well, mine is kind of all over the place. It really depends on what I'm flying. And I think that's really what it comes down to. You have a lot of different types of ships. And when you end up at the table, you have no idea what you're going to be across. So you want to know, you know, what are my strengths? what do I want to do? And Ron talked about a lot of that. So some of the things that I take into account is how maneuverable is it, are the ships that I'm taking. Boost has some impact. Barrel roll has a bigger impact, at least in my view, in terms of maneuverability. Am I going to need lanes? Am I flying small ships, large ships? And also, how many rounds do I want before I want to engage and actually start the first salvo, start rolling dice? You know, to give an example about different things that you might consider is, you know, the jump masters, for example. They're all pilot skill 3. So you have some options versus having different pilot skill levels in your own ship, in your own list, about how you're gonna, how are you going to set up. They're also pilot skill 3. So they're typically, most of the time, they're gonna be you're gonna be placing those first. So in that type of list, you're not really reacting to what other people are doing across the board. You kind of get the sense with your PS2s and your PS3s that you're gonna be putting down first. So those type of lists, you can actually just sit down at home at the table and plan out your opening engagement regardless of what people are gonna do on the other side of the table, because you're probably gonna run across some named pilots. So in those types of situations, I typically just sit down at home, figure out my ranges. You know, you got the range 2 to the asteroid. I know I wasn't in the podcast when we talked about the setting up asteroids, but for me, setting up asteroids is actually part of the turn 0, about placing your ships. And most people, when they set up an asteroid, they start setting up asteroids on the other side of the table to disrupt what the other people are doing. I actually always start either right in the center and then move back and place things on my side of the table, because I know the distances between where I place my ship to begin with and that first asteroid, because I placed it there. So I know if I put it at range 2 or at range 3 from the edge, I know exactly what speed I need to do in order to make a bank or a turn to get past it. So again, there's a lot of different variables that come into play.
So, like you were saying, if you have a bunch of pilot skill 2s or pilot skill 3s, your opponent's going to be able to react to you placing. And this is where I feel it's important that you have those potential setup tool bag before you get to the table. If, for instance, if I was playing a bunch of pilot skill 2s and I saw my opponent with Alterac and Fenrau, I know I'm not going to be able to maneuver them. They're going to be able to set up wherever they want and they'll be able to come around me. So that's in a situation where I might think, okay, I might want to have a fortress approach in this setup right here before they even place their ships down, or I might want to make sure I have that slow approach ready. That way, when we get to an engagement, we can fight in an area where there's more, where it's more open, and I have a chance to actually get his ships in my arc.
That's a great point. And yeah, you got to think about that. And I think a lot of that has to do with how maneuverable your own ships are. So know your list. I know that Ron, the ships that you took to Worlds, they had no barrel rolls and no boost, so you had to be really good at corralling ships into a kill box without the benefit of having a boost or a barrel roll or some other way to modify where you're going to end up when you start rolling dice. And I'm actually horrible at that, so props to you to be able to do that. You'll hardly ever see me flying anything without a barrel roll or a boost, because I'm not that good.
Says the North American champion.
Well,
he has.
Yeah, you have to know your strengths and your weaknesses, and
absolutely. And at least he knows his and he plays to his, which is why he does well.
Yeah.
Good lesson for other new players.
And yeah, so that has a lot to do with it. Whether you're reacting to the people across the board or across the map, or they're reacting to you. Then when you're looking across the board, what are they flying? Same thing. How maneuverable are they? Can they get past? How easily can they get around asteroids? And that's another thing that I take into account. Sometimes when you're doing a joust against the joust, you think you have the advantage for the joust, for the one-on-one joust. Maybe you have something like a party bus, and you have a couple torpedoes, or you have a party bus with some other things, or just a bunch of B-wings, and they're flying something that you feel is got inferior firepower. So you line up straight across from them, thinking, well, I'm gonna win the jousting battle. Well, a lot of the times, you know, why leave it up to the dice? The dice are luck. If you have a better jousting list, but it has some maneuverability, they're like B-wings or something like that, you can set up and make them break their formation to try to go through the rocks. Your B-wings can barrel roll back and forth, and you can basically set up a first engagement by putting those rocks in between, where you're going to have your whole formation still almost together, firing against maybe one or two ships, and the rest of their ships are not going to be able to get to you. So it's not just, you know, do I have the firepower superiority, you know, and am I going to be rolling more dice than them? It's how can I create an engagement that I'm going to have more ships focusing in on one target or two targets versus a just free-for-all. So those are some of the things that I could take into account. One of the things that I like to do when I'm flying ships with barrel roll, for example, this last list that I took to Ohio this past weekend, I took the two Special Forces TIE fighters, and I took Riad. All of them, you know, have barrel roll. So I actually always started Riad, who's the lowest pilot skill, 5, regardless whether I was playing against a high pilot skill or a low pilot skill. I always started him exactly below, behind the rock, with making sure that I had a lane either to the left or a lane to the right. So that gives me the ability to react after they move first, or after they place, if they're got low pilot skill, I can react with a barrel roll left or right. And if they don't have a pilot skill, they have higher pilot skill than me, they're going to place their ship. So that, to me, that's a move. So I know where they are, and I know which direction I'm going to start pushing, either left or right. One of the things that I do that I don't see enough people do, and if you watch some of the videos that they've recorded, I always do it. I always put my ship down, and then I use the one template for checking the distance of the barrel rolls. Whether it's, if it's a big ship, I'll use the flat side. If it's the small ship, I'll use the long side. So I put my ship where I want, and then I flip it to the other side of the barrel roll, because that way I know the lanes that I'm going to be in on the barrel roll. So I actually place my ship first. I set up the one template, and then I push it over to the side. So I always know where my barrel rolls are going to leave me down when I start getting into the asteroid fields. So just little things like that. Just a lot of people don't think about that. They just place. They look straight, but they don't know where the first barrel roll is going to put them. They don't know where the first boost is going to put them. So just make sure that you take that into account, that if you're flying a maneuverable ship, that you're thinking ahead of, if I barrel roll this way, and am I going to be able to do a 4K later and not hit a rock? And I don't have that much advice for the X-Wings that without vector thrusters, and they're not jumping around a lot. What I do with them is where I, in those situations, I'm not moving my ships around after they have their initial moves. I mean, after they have, you know, they move and they're stuck there. That's where I use where I put the asteroids to do that. So that's where I know that if I do a 4-forward, I'm going to be parallel to an asteroid. If I do a 2-forward, I'm going to be about 2 spaces back from an asteroid that that's at range 2 for me, and a 3 speed will get me past just behind it. And I think that those are all things that you guys talked about in the past, and I think Ron just mentioned it right here a minute ago too. And finally, I think is just practice. I do practice at home. I practiced at home for about 2 hours before Gen Con last year, and the only thing that I practiced was how do I slow play and keep my and basically change my arcs at a 45 degree with keeping my slaver in the same spot without moving forward, just using the barrel roll, the soft and the barrel roll to keep my slaver back from without having it stress itself, just to see how things play out. And you can see that actually in during the match with Kyle Adams with the two the Brobots, when he was flying the Brobots, that I used that tactic to basically draw him in and then basically force him to overcommit to that. So just practice that at home. And I think not just that, practice your open engagements at home. Sometimes do it by placing the rocks yourself. Sometimes just grab a bunch of asteroids, throw them up in the air and see where they land, and just try to practice for the unexpected, because your opponent's going to be putting some down. And after a while, it'll become second nature.
All good stuff. Thank you very much. So I'm going to go through kind of what I think Ron and Marcel touched on a lot of what I had already written down. So I'm just going to try to sum up, and then we'll see if Alex and Andrea have anything else to kind of add as we continue. So one of the questions I ask myself is, what do I want to get done in that opening engagement? So I try to identify my primary target, but I have to be careful. I know this is something that I'm always telling myself, I have to be careful not to overcommit. It's really easy to look at somebody else's list and say, all right, I want to kill Sunterfell. Like, he has to die. Or I need to kill Fenrau right now. But if by turn 4, they have served up Old Tarak, range 1 of all your ships, and Fenrau is range 3 in a corner, and you have... you're not going to hit him, or he's out of battle, take the ship that you're being given. That's when you hear people talk about target of opportunity. That's it right there. If you can, if somebody feeds you a ship, sometimes you got to feed it. Now, exactly. Sometimes you just got to feed your list. Now, you do have to be careful, not to. So one thing that, Marcel is really good at is kind of, I'm going to say, like, bluff feeding you a ship. Like, oh, here it is. Here's a ship that you can kill. Oh, no, just kidding. You just got flanked. So you have to be careful not to overcommit to what you think you're being given. So,
yeah, you don't want to get what we call baited. You don't want to, especially if that ship has things like slam, boost. You got to be careful, because it may look like you're hitting that K-wing. But in all reality, you're just getting suckered into not attacking it.
And I think it's important to note that bluffing is not just about, because Ron talked about kiting. You know, you get a really maneuverable ship, or you get a really juicy target, and you know that the opponent's going to want to go for it. Whether, you know, Manaro is the obvious ones, but there's other ones out there that are juicy. They're mean, but yet they're squishy enough to where you feel you can kill it, and then next thing you know, you're chasing a fast ship while the entire list is poking you in the back. There's a different type of bluff, one that I love to do, and I not to touch back on the regionals, because I know it's not a regional recap, but that's all I did all weekend, and that's it works so well, which is you bluff with what you want. When you want somebody not to shoot something, you put it right in front of them. I know it sounds stupid, but if you, for example, the list that I was flying was quick draw, backdraft, and Riad, and the only way that I win is when the opponent tries to attack either Backdraft or Riad first, because they're afraid to get shot again by Quick Draw. Which basically Backdraft and Riad, I had them loaded out in the way that's really hard to kill. So I bluffed every time. And you guys know the list was doing great. I mean, I think the current record is like 24-3 or something like that.
Yeah, I was one of those.
Yeah, you're Dengaru. So what I...
Yeah, me too, oh, yeah. Darn it.
So the... What I do is, and by the way, I'm never going to fly this list again. I retired it. I got tired of it. But with Quick Draw, what I did is I bluffed. I put Quick Draw at range one of your entire list. I used him as bait, and I said, and I didn't even take the focus action. I would put Quick Draw range one of all of your ships and take a target lock and say, shoot me, I dare you. The reality is, if they actually shot it, I would lose the match, because then, you know, his ability only happens once, and then he only has two agility, and he's like, he dies so fast. But those bluffs really, you know, it kind of freaks people out. It's like, oh, he's putting it there. He probably don't want to shoot it. They're afraid to get shot. You still have shields. You're just going to eat a couple shields. And they go after the range two and the range three tokened up. Defensive ships. So same thing with your opening engagement. Sometimes you want to bluff in terms of you put a ship that you actually want to keep alive, you make it there available, and you just go in with it, and it'll just throw people off. It's kind of a mind game, but I kind of went inside on a brain thing. But when I wrote down bluff, it's not just coming in and then running away. It's coming in and making them think that's the ship that you're trying to sacrifice. And it's just a bluff. You're just hoping that they let it go and go after the harder targets.
Yeah, and then sometimes behind that bluff, there you can have some good math that says, hey, I might take some damage here if they do shoot it, but... I might live at the end, or my ship won't take as much damage as they maybe think. I think that was kind of the, when Dengaru first came out, right? When people started playing Dengar, a lot of times people would shoot Dengar in his arc. And you would kind of, people like, oh, I'm just going to go joust Dengar and lose and be like, man, why did I lose? I sent four ships at Dengar and he's still alive and I lost 100-0. You know, it's the math behind that list says if you're shooting me, I'm probably going to win still. But knowing some of those probabilities there, because the reality is if you can kill Dengar and you know how to, basically don't shoot him in his arc, get behind him, block him, and then don't shoot him in his arc, you're going to win that match every time. I'm not playing Dengaru at regionals either.
Yeah, and I don't win that much every time because I have no self-restraint and I always have to shoot.
Right, exactly. No, kill Dengar. Shoot him. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, I use the exact same tactic at Worlds with Torkoal Mux, like, all the time. Like, I would march Torkoal Mux right in there and, you know, people think, oh man, this guy's going to be so easy to kill. And then Torkoal Mux, like, gets in, makes a block, lowers someone to pilot skill 0, and then the rest of your squad nukes down that ship before it gets to shoot, and then Torkoal gets unscathed.
Nice.
Yeah, that's evil. I remember the first time you guys did it, too. It was evil.
So, yeah, there's... I know we're a little on a tangent, but there is some... some strategy in that kind of bringing something that people are unfamiliar with, where, you know, we, the Gold Squadron Special, right? We flew a lot of Torkoal Mux and took it to other stores and caught people off guard with it. Now Dengaru and all those kind of kind of shenanigans. Marcel,
yeah, the first time you played Dengaroo against me and I had no idea what was going on.
Yes, it was awesome.
Now, before okay. Dengaroo was ever a thing.
Right, all right, all right. So Andrew, you can attest to it, right? I flew Dengaroo before Jeff Burling made.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Jeff Burling. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Okay,
it's on the record. I love you, Jeff. Yeah. I love you. You're a super cool dude, but.
Yeah, but you wrecked me with that, like, way before it ever was a thing.
Yep.
Yeah, you flew it right away when everyone was like, I'm going to run three of these. And you're like, no, I want to run Dengaroo. Yeah, man, it was
awesome. Look at this.
Yeah. Exactly.
It was awesome. Anyway, I'll stop talking about myself.
I thought it was you just being cheap and not wanting to buy three drum masters.
Well, I mean, there was that too, but.
Yeah. Two's good enough. So let's get back on track here. So when I create my opening setups, you know, everybody kind of has their own process. I'll tell you about my process here. I like to have three different plans for my setup. We already talked about fortressing. I have a fortress plan, and usually I'll use this against a squad that I'm unfamiliar with. If I say, man, I have no idea what this guy is doing, I've never flown against this ship. You know, I might take a turn, fortress my ships. That way I at least have a turn to make a plan. Cause I don't want to just stand there and stall for time, cause that's unsportsmanlike. Like before a match. And then on top of that, you know, it just, if you can get a beat on where they're going to be maneuvering on the map, that can help. my second plan is a slow roll. So those swarms right now are not very popular, in the meta. You should have a plan for it because you never know when you're going to come across it. But you know, going slow and stringing them out through the asteroids. So you'll see a lot of six tie swarm and seven tie swarm. They'll set up, you know, if you have a six, let's say they'll do three in the front, three in the back. But if you can engage them and have them have turned at a 45 degree angle and taken them long enough through the asteroids, there's a good chance you'll have them in a more of a column so that maybe only two ships can shoot you because they've all had to turn. That just helps you get less shots on you, makes them less effective, and you can take some of them out without having, you know, six TIE fighters shooting down your back. Now, one of the biggest mistakes that I am constantly trying to combat for my own playing, when you're doing slow rolls, you have to be careful not to get caught in the corner. I lost my match to Francois Moret at Gen Con because I let myself get caught in the corner. With Manaroo. Now, because I slow rolled, and he had his double ghosts and a Y-wing, and he came in really fast. He was in the middle of the board before my ships weren't even halfway up the side, and I, for some reason, made the choice to continue Manaroo into the corner. He turned his ships into the corner and just annihilated her. She was gone.
And that's the importance of having flexibility within your setup formation. You know, he saw an opportunity and he took, I'm going to go fast and jump right on this guy and see if I can get him trapped. And yep. It worked.
So now kind of my own personal rule for myself is assuming your opponent is in the opposite corner. If your opponent turns in and is at the and you're not at the halfway point by the time they've turned in. Don't continue into the corner. You're going to get trapped. Bad things are going to happen. Get into the middle of the map and have some space, especially if you have ships with repositioning. That way you can meet them in open space to be able to keep your options open. Because the problem is you get caught in the corner. You're like, oh, their only option is to do a hard left two. I know exactly where they're going to be.
Kaboom.
You know? Yeah, exactly. And then you're dead. And then my third plan is an aggressive plan. If I want to get all my ships engaged in the same turn and get very quickly into my opponent's face, because I noticed that they parked a ship on a rock on that first turn because they miscalculated. I say, all right, everybody, as fast as you can go, get in there and try to take advantage of that person being stressed or something like that. Or if you have that confidence and you say, hey, my list is a hard counter to yours, whatever that might be, maybe you just go for it. I mean, you have to really decide. It really depends on your play style, you know, which one you're going to take. But those are the kind of the three different ways I look at it. And then for each of these plans, you can then make it, take it a step further. And I want to talk about Andrea and this amazing document that she made for Worlds. Andrea, can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was good practice for me.
I was inspired by Andrea to start writing down what I was doing in my head, but now I have a more solid plan because from each of those setups, I have basically the first 2 to 3 turns mapped out in my mind what I'm going to do. And then after that, you have to freelance because you have to see what your opponent's going to do. But if you have a plan that you can execute in several different ways, I know it's a high level X-Wing, right? People are going to watch you play, so you can't do the exact same thing every time so that, you know, people don't get a beat on you unless it's that good, right?
I mean, I did this exact same thing with, you know, I flew the same list that document's based off of. And at the Squadron Outrider Cup, at last round, I got paired, you know, Gold Squadron Special against Pelp Defenders. And I just went right back to, you know, the maneuvers that were set up in that document. Even though I didn't have the document with me, I'd practiced it so many times. I'm like, I'm going to set up like this. And I just did exactly what I wanted to do, which was a slow roll on the first turn. And I could either extend into a medium or stick with the slow. But based off of his maneuver, I knew I was going to go the medium. And it was like clockwork. I think in that game, out of both defenders, I think only one of them actually fired dice before they were off the table.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal. What I had done, because I flew this Gold Squadron Special at Worlds as well, I had very little practice with this list in actual gameplay, so I had to spend a lot more time at home by myself really working through some of the placements and the maneuvers and how to navigate what my plan would be for those initial turns. And then the next step of that after that is working through how this list works against different matchups and having a plan on how to deal with those. But basically what I did was lay out exactly how everything needed to be set up, like even drew like little diagrams for myself because I knew by the time I was getting done with, you know, a 6 to 8 round day, my brain was not going to be functioning on all cylinders, and any way that I could not be thinking about it as much, the better. So I would literally, before every game, I would flip to my initial setup page that had my diagram of how all my shifts needed to be laid out and my different starting formations of if I had a slow start, a medium start where I had to pick it up, or just a get out and go quick start. And I had 3 turns laid out for all of my ships for each of those starts, and I looked at it before every single match. It was incredibly helpful.
Yep. And that what you can't see, unfortunately, because this is a podcast, she put all the ships in the book with a diagram with different colors for the different types of speed of maneuvers she was doing, like her slow or medium and her fast. And you could actually see on the diagram with, you know, some clarity in your head, like, oh, wow, like, if I do this setup, I won't clip any rocks. Like, if there's a ship in front of me and I do this 2-speed maneuver, like, I'll clear it. The document really was actually really impressive. The only thing that wasn't on there was the fortressing, which honestly was my fault because I didn't prepare her or tell her to put it into the document. I really should have mentioned it, and it, like I said, it was my downfall of Worlds.
Yeah, but the other part of this, aside from the prep work, what I also incorporate into this, which I encourage all players to get in the habit of doing, I put together kind of a list, if you will, of what I thought were going to be the most common mashups that I would face. Ironically enough, I didn't face any of them at Worlds, but that's a separate thing. But I put together, you know, some notes for myself of when I'm flying against a list like this, these are the types of ships that I want to ideally kill first. These are my target priority ships, assuming, like we've talked about, someone doesn't just feed up another one to me and then I'm just going to eat it for breakfast. I also think about how I want to do my rock placement for the different matchups and how I want to do my setup for the different matchups. And then I left a whole bunch of room for notes for myself to take thinking about the matchup beforehand. And then if I actually played it, I put down more notes in terms of what worked and what didn't work, and if I faced it again, what would I have done differently? And that's all. A lot of that is, like we've talked about, things you can do in advance, and it's a great way to just kind of shoot the breeze with a bunch of friends that play this game. That's what we ended up doing right before Worlds. Me, Ron, and Mike Jones, who has, you know, been on this podcast before, we just sat down and we're like, okay, here's what my list is, here's a potential matchup, what do we do? Like, how do I place my rocks? What's my plan? How do I win this game? And then, if I actually faced it, figure out what worked and what didn't work, and evaluate that so you can get better the next time you play it.
Alright. So I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit. So, like, growing up, I was into boxing, and we used to go boxing a lot. And there's this common saying in boxing, leaving it in the gym. I think there's something to be said with also, and this again, just playing devil's advocate because I do a lot of practicing at home. But I think for you got to know yourself a little bit, because there's such a thing as practicing too much, overdoing it, and just trying to where you've kind of ingrained it into your head so much that when you're in a situation, you're kind of working off a muscle memory versus reading and reacting to what's across the board. Either that, or just getting to the point where you're kind of sick of it and you're just not having fun anymore. So I think those are things that you have to kind of know about yourself. Is are you that type of person that is okay with repetition and doing those kind of things, or is that really just going to affect you later on? Later Absolutely. On when you're playing, because yeah, I again, it's coming just from a boxing background where people do the same things in the gym so much that when they get into an actual fight, they don't know how to react to something that they didn't practice against.
Oh, I totally agree, but I think the document for her, this was really something she did for herself, because she knew she wasn't going to have the same amount of table time practice that we all had. Like, leading up to Worlds, we all, you know, for weeks, we would bring our ships to the table, we would practice. She didn't have that, so she was like, you know what, I know I'm not going to be able to put 20 hours of practice in, so what I'll do instead is I'll do as much practice as I can on my own at home, and then leave the flying to when I get to the tournament.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, reading and reacting is definitely something that you get better at as you continue to play. The more table time you have and the more things you've seen, I think the better you're going to be at reading and reacting. it's actually perfect. Today, on Facebook, somebody, I believe is in the UK, X-Wing group, was asking, like, you know, how do I, it was perfect, right? Cause we're recording this today. You know, how do I go about doing a opening setup? And I was like, oh, hey, we're actually talking about that today.
Wait 1 week.
yeah, listen in 1 week after I finish editing everything. We've talked about, you know, that we have ideas of how we want to set up our ships. And the thing is that, you know, we can't tell you, hey, this is the perfect setup. Always set up, you know, range one with a one spacer and put your second ship at the front of range one. You know, we can't tell you those things, because when it comes down to it, you have to put it on the table. You have to be able to identify your opponent's matchup and your lists. Be able to identify mistakes that you make in order to be better. You know, it took me a long time to figure out that I was getting, when I would lose games, that I was getting usually trapped in a corner and trying to figure out and work through that. Just last weekend, I was playing a game with Darwin, and I took a risk, and I was like, I know I shouldn't go in the corner because I have a big base ship and he can block me with his big base ship, and then I'll be just stuck in the corner. And I was like, but maybe he won't go in the corner. And that's exactly what he did, because his thought was, if he goes in the corner, I'll block him and he'll be screwed. And that's exactly what happened.
What you're saying is really good, and something to always keep in mind. I always tell Andrea this all the time, because it's easy to fall into. There is actually no hard set rule for anything, for the most part. Everything you do in X-Wing is situational. It's based on you. It's based on your opponent, their ships, your ships. So you do have to react some all the time, you know, but you can have some guides that can help you make a better decision. Everything we're giving you is a guide. It's not a hard, fast rule. It's not like, well, if you set up this way and you do this setup, you're going to win. That's not always going to be the case.
So, Alex, do you have anything you wanted to add there?
I'll add on to what you were, to what Marcel was talking about, rather, about the Devil's Advocate. My opening setups are kind of a mix of really what all you guys said. I don't really have as much of a set thing in my head with lists. I kind of fly by the seat of my pants sometimes. I do like flying ships in formation, so that's always in my mind is with my list. Does it benefit me to fly my ships in formation versus my opponent's list or not? I'll try to set up a fortress if either my opponent's list is a hard counter to mine, or if I'm just not sure what he's doing, I'll just fortress in not for much more than maybe a turn or two and wait for an opening. But I do play a lot of reactionary play. I like to let my opponent make their mistakes and then capitalize. And I also like making my opponent choose between bad decisions. There was a game I played, it was a while ago, against a buddy of mine. And I had dangled a Soonter. I think Soonter, he would have died if he would have shot at Soonter. But there was another ship that had one hull left. It was Ryad. Ryad had one hull left, but there was Soonter right in front of him, range one, and he's like, oh my god, I can't believe I'm not going to be shooting at Soonter. And then, of course, Soonter killed him because he didn't shoot at him. So I like doing that, making my opponent either make the first mistake or choose between just bad choices.
Bad choices or good choices?
Yeah. Every bad choice is a good choice for somebody.
So turn zero has a lot of different things. So I just want to throw one last thing out there, and I'm going to call this part of turn zero. So when you are setting up, even before you put your ships on the board and your asteroids and everything, and you're just laying out your cards and you're doing, you know, you're doing your small talk, saying hello to your opponent and all this other stuff. Turn zero, word of advice to everyone out there. If you've been playing for a long time, and you've done decently well, please don't use all your challenge coins as shields. Oh my god! Please don't. So this actually happened 2 days ago. So round six of the tournament, and I'm sitting here across another player, and then the guy, the opponent's next to me. They're setting up, and the guy in front, popular guy on the internet. I guess I didn't know, but I guess he's internet famous. He looks across and says, "Do you mind if I use my shield tokens as? I mean, my challenge coins as shield tokens." And then the guy next to me looks at me, kind of like giggles a little. He's like, yeah, go ahead, you know, whatever, dude. I think he was flying a triple defender or something. And then he says, well, I only have 8 challenge coins. Do you mind if I use my store championship trophy as the 9th?
Oh my god.
Oh,
that's a little much.
The man brought 8 challenge coins and a store championship trophy as shields. Don't do that.
Look at me. Please, look at
don't.
Me.
Please don't. Anyway, I just... That's a turn zero, let's call it. Don't do that.
That's a don't show up to the tournament.
That's turn point one, leaving your house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should that's I walk out with my trophies?
No, yeah, and then I brought it up at dinner later with you know the group that we went out with, and I guess this person's famous for doing that, and that's probably not what you want to be famous for.
Fair.
Well, yeah. I mean, so me personally, the challenge coins, I don't think they don't bother me anymore because I've seen a lot of people do it. The trophy though is a little much. I saw it the first time. I think it was one of the Howards did it, and it was to be funny during one of their tournaments. I'm like, okay, first time, but yeah. It's not funny anymore.
And those guys are a little goofy to begin with. Like at Worlds, one of them was wearing like a Cobra Kai outfit.
All right, all right. Never bring that up again, ever.
Yeah, let's not.
Sorry.
Let's delete that from memory. And for you, those of you who don't know, he's knocked me out of the top 16.
Yeah.
Yeah, he swept your leg.
He swept the leg and followed through. Yeah.
All right, and just to kind of wrap this up here, you know, planning your opening setups is important. Having a plan, you know, we've talked about a couple different ways to go for it, but I think we can all agree that if you have some sort of a plan, you execute it, and then once you figure out whether that plan was successful or not, you can evaluate what happened and how to improve in the future. And that is a big advantage to having a plan, is that after you've executed it, you're able to evaluate it and kind of work from there. Sometimes I know when I have worked from the seat of my pants, at the end of the game, I go, what the heck did I do? You get to the end and go, wow, how did that happen? You know, so if you didn't have a camera on it or anything like that. But.
And one thing I forgot about my quote plan, don't be afraid to deviate from said plan in the middle of the game. Don't get locked into, well, this plan has worked so well in the past. If you see your opponent starting to guess your moves and size up exactly what you're starting to do, do something different. I've had games where they're like, oh, I totally didn't think that you were going to do that. And I'm like, well, that's the point. Yeah, don't be afraid to deviate.
So we have coming up here on February 4th and 5th, our Chicago Regional, and we thought we'd talk about the possible meta we're going to see. Not only Wave 9, but like we mentioned during the intro, we have Wave 10 going to be legal here. You could argue that basically this Chicago Regional is going to definitely set some things for the meta. You know, there's a lot of people who do play on Vassal, and you could argue that there's a meta already established there, but there's plenty of people who don't. The three ships that are coming out here, we have the Sabine's TIE Fighter, we have the Quad Jumper, and the Upsilon Shuttle, which I looked up, if you're saying it like in English, it is Upsilon, not Upsilon, but if you're saying it in Greek, it's actually Ypsilon.
I like Greek.
Would you have looked up how to pronounce it in the Greek language?
YouTube, how to say the Greek alphabet in like a Greek person or something like that. It was great. And I checked it against like five or six different videos, and they were all agreeing with each other. It was great. Let's go through Wave 9 kind of meta things, right? So some of the popular architects that we saw in Wave 9, which we, of course, will see some of them at the Chicago Regional. We saw, you know, your... Palp Defenders. Most commonly you have Ryad and Vessery, and then you have like Ryad, Vessery, and then another ship, sometimes Karner Jack, sometimes Omega Leader. One of the big ones that is called the Omnom Special. You have your Rear Admiral Sherenu with Hotshot Co-Pilot and Darth Vader and a Juking Defender. You have Dengaru, you have the Atani Mind Link squads, Thug Life, Corrin and Miranda. You have Dash Miranda. I mean, there's a ton of lists. And you know what? One of the encouraging things when I was kind of going through this list of Wave 9 lists is that there's a lot of them. The meta is definitely very diverse right now. Kanan Biggs, Brobots, Ketsu and Asajj, Dengar Bossk, anything like Bossk Alpha Strikes, Asajj and TLTs.
I mean, even B-Swarm is making a comeback with Collision Detector.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff. Actually, Kanan is what I saw a lot. The Kanan Ghost. There was Kanan Biggs with the double tap TLTs. Yeah, Nathan ID flying Kanan with Corrin. He went undefeated during Swiss. I mean, just it's all over the place. It's awesome.
And then, you know, now we're going to add Wave 10 to the mix. And I've kind of started going through a little bit and just kind of recognize some things that we might see, some shenanigans that are possible.
Started off with Ahsoka Tano, which is 24 points, a TIE Fighter Veteran Instincts build. So Sabine's Masterpiece, then a Captured TIE, Jyn Erso, and a Scavenger Crane.
Yeah, so for 24 points right there, you have a TIE fighter that you can't shoot because it's at PS9, and the captured TIE doesn't let you shoot it unless you're at PS9 or 10. Scavenger Crane lets you pick back up that captured TIE title, and then you can use the Jyn Erso in there handing out focus tokens to friendly ships, including yourself, for people in ARC. Or you can go another route and do a bombing Ahsoka Tano. With you take Sabine's Masterpiece, you put Sabine in there, which gives you a bomb slot, and you could take a proton bomb, you could take any bomb you want.
So where'd you get that one from?
Where did I get that one from? That's just my head.
Okay, because that's funny, because I'm not logged in right now, and I was trying to type it in, and I put together what I was trying to call the Marcel special, but you're killing me, Dion. You're writing it on here already. So it's that one. Ahsoka with Veteran Instinct, Captured TIE, Sabine's Masterpiece, Sabine Wren Crew with Scavenger Crane and Proton Bombs. Which basically brings her to 29 points.
Yep.
And then two K-Wings with it, fully loaded. One as a damage with clusters and clusters for damage, ion for control. The other one with the Connor Net for control and the seismic for damage. And then, of course, all the other things that the regular K-Wings have. And it leaves you at with a 2-point bid, 98 points. So you have a 90, you have a pilot skill 9 Ahsoka with the captured TIE, dropping automatic crits on everyone. And then if you get to kill someone, you get it back, another 5-point proton bomb back. Anyway, you're trying to steal my list.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's just so good. And you could even go the other route and maybe do cluster mines. You're more likely to drop some things, drop that on somebody and kill them. Scavenger Crane, get them back. I think it's a lot of fun.
I love this so much. You guys have no idea. So Ahsoka and Sabine together, and I get to drop bombs. This is like the holy trinity of things that I would like to do in.
Oh, I love this. I was telling folks that's actually what I was planning on taking to the Hoth Open, is Ahsoka loaded and then a couple K-Wings, because everybody's first target whenever you got the what do they call it, the Galaxy Note. Everybody's first target is always Sabine. Well, guess what? You can't shoot Sabine no more because she's got the Captured TIE title. She's just going to be dropping crits on people, and then she's going to get it back.
So awesome.
Yeah, so I do expect some savvy players to be playing Ahsoka Tano. Another possibility thing here is we have the Kylo Ren crew card and the Kylo Ren shuttle and the Upsilon shuttle coming out. One build possible is taking Rear Admiral Shernu with Kylo Ren crew, Hotshot Co-Pilot, and Gunner. An engine upgrade for 62 points. And if you're not familiar with Kylo Ren, he's the one, as an action for the crew card, you give somebody the I'll show you the dark side condition. And then what happens is if you deal somebody, if you hit somebody with an uncancelled crit, and that's whether they have shields or not,
You actually search their whole deck and pick which one you want.
That is a mean card. You have Blinded Pilot. There's also the ones that drop you to Pilot Skill 0, Stun Pilot, and Shaken Pilot. I mean, you're just dealing damage under shields, and if somebody's flying Corrin and you do this to them twice, they're dead.
So, question.
Yep.
Is Kylo going to mean the end for Corrin and maybe even Inquisitor?
It really could be. I mean, that is a... That's a brutal combo. I feel like, honestly, it takes them a while to develop these cards. My first reaction was that Kylo was probably put in the game against Suntar and the Aces because he was dominating so much. But the Defenders ended up being so good that kind of like pushed Vader and Suntar out of the game. But now Kylo's still amazing because you got like you said.
You mean Corrin.
Yeah, Corrin and the Inquisitor are still around. So, I mean, Kylo Ren is pretty gross. I expect to see more Kylo Ren from Wave 10 at the regional more than anything.
And, you know, the other thing about that is Kylo Ren will always be good against ships that regen because they don't care. Unless you can ditch damage cards, then it doesn't matter. And then that's maybe where some of the, I believe there is a droid that lets you ditch damage cards. I think it's a roll.
Yeah, there's a one-point droid that allows you to flip a damage card down, or there's the repeating droid that allows you to ditch a face-down damage card.
Yeah, you got to roll for it, I think.
Yeah, you got to roll for it. You have to get a focus or an evade result. That one's kind of hard, though. The 1.1 is just a guarantee to flip one face down.
Yeah, which is still, in a way, getting rid of regen,
right.
Regen ships, because you're getting rid of R2-D2 and R5-P9 at that point, because you're taking this instead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then some other options, you know, just taking the platform of the Upsilon Shuttle is really good. You got 4 attack dice backed by 12 health and a way better dial than the Lambda Shuttle. This thing, I mean, good players have always used the Lambda Shuttle in battle, but now you can take, I think almost anybody will be able to take this Upsilon Shuttle and then just shove it into battle, 4 or 5 attack dice, have some survivability, and do some damage. You can put Palpatine if you want onto it. Still have room for, you can actually fit like Vessery and a Delta Squadron defender in there. So we might see some new variations on the Palp Aces archetype, or maybe people start leaving Palpatine behind to have space for other things. You got the Lieutenant Dormitz Upsilon Shuttle that lets you deploy ships range 1 to 2 away from you. And if you put Hyperwave Comm Scanner on it, you place Lieutenant Dormitz first as far forward in range 1 as possible. Then you place your other ships, something really, really fast, you know, as far as possible at the very edge of the range 2 ruler. And that first turn, they get focus because of the Hyperwave Comm Scanner. You send them like 5 forward, target lock, blow some stuff up. And that's kind of, to go back to what we were talking about earlier with the opening setups, this Hyperwave Comm Scanner card is going to change some things, and Lieutenant Dormitz as well, because now people can start having some more shenanigans with when ships are being placed and where, similar to the Heroes of the Resistance Han Solo. I think we're going to start seeing some of those more abilities that can start affecting the opening setup rather than just our vanilla setups. So that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I do like the idea of them exploring the space of, turn 0 having abilities that affect. It's kind of cool. I'm really looking forward to seeing the results of this regional. The only thing I'm not looking forward to is having to make the hard calls on abilities that aren't 100% clear yet.
Yeah, don't send emails. Ask today. we'll talk about it then. Some other cards that we're going to be seeing, I believe, we're going to be seeing some of the Jyn Erso crew card that we saw that came with the U-Wing. The newest card that was talked about today in a FFG article is Boshek. Lots of shenanigans possible with that. Alex, can you give me a little bit on Boshek?
Yeah, so I love this card now because Paul Heaver had said that the basis of this card was the Princess Bride, and I found that hilarious. It's basically, I'm going to pull up the exact wording right now, but basically if you are touching a ship, you get to look at their dial, and they must choose, I think if you choose to look at the dial, they must choose a maneuver adjacent to what they do. And they can do that maneuver while stressed, so any red maneuvers, that doesn't matter, they can still manipulate it. So that's really cool. I really liked the example that FFG had in their article. It was they had two friendly ships. One was an X-Wing, and I think, I can't remember what the other one was, but basically the X-Wing was stressed, and it had dialed in a 5 straight, which was going to be pointing it at absolutely nothing. So they had it touch, activate Boshek, and then change its dial to a 5K and have it end up turning back towards the fight. And I really like that example. Yep.
Awesome. So there's some shenanigans there that you can pull for sure. I think we're going to see Boshek, at least from a couple of high level players that want to start taking advantage. You know, we all are pretty, you know, when you start playing for a while, you start getting pretty familiar with the dials. But now there's another way you kind of have to start thinking about the dials, and that's what move is next to that move. And then when somebody else has Boshek, you're like, wait, are they going to try to Boshek me? Should I pick a move next to the one I actually want to do? You know, you start getting that rabbit hole of, should I do what I think that they want me to do, that they think I'm going to, you know, just keep going.
The Princess Bride. Going.
Yep.
Well, I know that you know that I know, and I know that you know that I know.
We're going to see Scavenger Crane. It's basically, you have there extra munitions for a bunch of extra things. As long as you're killing something, you can get a Z-Swarm with some missiles, with scavenger cranes, blow some stuff up, and get your missiles back. It makes a list like that better.
Yeah, I think scavenger crane is going to be the gateway to a lot of jank lists.
Yeah. Using scavenger crane with the smuggling compartments on YT-1300s and 2400s, and I've been seeing some countermeasures builds popping up for those ships for Rey. You know, reuse countermeasures because you can, after you blow some stuff up. The Jakku Gunrunner, the quad jumper with space beam tractor array, sticking one of those things in your list for 17 points and rolling up to somebody and says, here's your tractor beam, enjoy, for an action. That's awesome. Like, I am really tempted to bring a list that uses the Jakku Gunrunner. Like,
Pilot Skill one?
Yeah, it's the PS1.
Yeah, that's great, because you basically can take an ace, a small, and just as an action, put it in front of a rock, and you're going to force it to fly through a rock and get no actions. I mean, for 17 points, or wow.
Yeah, it's awesome. I really like it. And another really popular card that we saw out of the U-Wing, that's out of the U-Wing from Wave 10, is Expertise. I've heard mixed reviews on this card. I love it. I think it's a great card. Really good on Rey. She already can reroll blanks plus focus. I mean, that's target lock focus. You can use your action for focus for defense or something like that. Or boosting, yeah, if you have engine upgrade on there. I mean, there's lots of possibilities. Tons of new cards are coming out. We don't know anything definitive, but I just kind of wanted to touch on it because our regional's coming up. Is there anything, any combination or ship that you're excited to see, guys, or pilots or anything?
I'm excited about the Decimator with Kylo, even though it's going to be very frustrating for a lot of people, but I like the combination competitively.
I have no idea, to be completely honest with you. I was looking about this, and I've been practicing what I've been practicing for the regionals coming up in Ohio. And when I found out that the regionals in Chicago was going to have all of this stuff legal, I don't have time to go through all this stuff and try to figure something out, so I'm just going back to something safe. I'm actually going to fly the jumps, some variation of the jumps, because no matter what comes out, they're going to have enough meat to take some damage. But yeah, I have no idea what I'm going to run into, and all of these things, Ahsoka with Sabine and Kylo Ren on a 4-dice ship. I mean, it's just scary.
I was going to say, yeah, when I was planning at regionals, Wave 10, it's not even on my horizon. I was like, oh, all these reveals that we've been doing lately, cool stuff. I won't actually get into building it until store champs season or worlds. I wasn't even worried about this in the slightest. And then we got hit with the release date, and I'm like, oh my God.
I'm not sure that anybody, players or randomized TOs, are particularly excited about this, because, you know, from a player standpoint, there's a lot of new information, like you guys are saying, that there's a lot of big changes in this, between a lot of new conditions, a lot of really powerful cards that are going to drastically affect the meta. And the question is whether or not people are going to try and take the time to really go through this and practice it, or if people had already maybe proxied it, or maybe some people that, like we've said, were on Vassal and have practiced some of these things. You know, some of those people might have a little bit more of an advantage. And then there's all these things that aren't really clear from a rules standpoint, particularly with the conditions, that's going to be a little bit difficult for the TOs to really to navigate for the day.
Be nice to your TOs.
Yeah, we do our best.
It's not our fault that FFG doesn't provide us with a fact when they surprise us with a new wave of ships. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, so you are the going to be the TO and basically the main person for the first regional that will be happening right after this release, correct? So my question is, I know they regulate like some of the rule of a lot of the rules. How much leeway, if any, do you have to say, you know what, there is no FAQ with this new ships, there's no clarity on a lot of it, so anything that got released this week is not legal? Like, how much leeway do you have?
According to FFG, if you guys remember when this came out, we posted on, even on the podcast page, we posted, listen, we're not going to announce what's legal until we have official word from FFG. And the reason why was, as the TO, I wanted to make sure that it was 100% legal, and I had no option or choice to make that decision, since there's no FAQ. And, you know, the other logistical problem I had was, there are going to be people who are traveling to our regional, like, for instance, Paul LaRue from Canada, who might not get their ships before they have to leave. Or if they ordered online, there's no way you're getting your ships. If you pre-ordered at Amazon or Team Covenant, your ships won't be here. So you either have to buy new ships if you want to play with them, or borrow somebody else's that had already got them, or just buy them again. So FFG's response was, they felt that it will be legal. I don't have a say in whether or not it is legal. And they felt that they understood my concerns, and they felt that they were very valid, and that they felt that they would look to address those concerns next year, but this is the path they've chosen for this year, and they feel it's appropriate for this level of an event, which, by them making it, dropping it from a premier level event to a formal level event, it does seem like they are making regionals seem maybe less competitive of a level than it used to be.
That's a good segue for what I was thinking too. Regionals used to be premier, and I don't know if a lot of people remember that, because when we originally said that we were waiting for clarification, everybody's, you know, messaging us going, why are you bothering? This is formal tier. It says it right on the website, blah, 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 blah. Well, it didn't used to be that way. And I kind of don't agree with that being downgraded, because, like you said, people are traveling. People are making you know, hotel plans, stuff like this, to go out of state. They could be traveling, they could be driving, they could be flying in, what have you. I think that makes it a pretty competitive event, and I don't really think that regionals is just a casual level thing. I definitely don't agree with that decision by FFG.
My other issue is, and I know Vassal people and people who've play tested has always have a little bit of advantage because, you know, they get to play with, they're able, it's much easier to proxy a ship and play on Vassal. You're kind of a little bit ahead because you don't have to like make a dial, do all that stuff. And that's kind of the advantage of playing on Vassal. But like with our specific tournament in this specific situation, everyone that plays on Vassal and everyone that's in playtesting and use these ships, unfortunately, will have a decided advantage over those who haven't. And that, I don't know how I feel about that as a TO and as someone that, you know, always tries to promote fair play, level playing fields. That I don't know, that kind of rubs me the wrong way. But you know what? We're going to make the best of it. We're going to have a good time. Our TOs are going to meet. We're going to make decisions on the unknown card interactions, and whatever decision we make, that'll be the decision that everyone knows before the start of the tournament, and that's the one that we're going to go with until FFG can clear it up for us.
Perhaps the archives are incomplete.
If an item does not appear in our records, it does not exist.
All right, so we're in the library. Alex, we're in a different part of the library. What are we talking about today?
We're in the hangar part of the library. Which is weird.
This hangar in the library?
Yep. So, want to do something different this week. I mentioned when we started the archives segment that we're going to be dabbling into both pilots and ships. So, us being Gold Squadron, we got to start off with the Y-Wing.
Oh, get wrecked. Let's go.
So, the variant that you see in X-Wing is the BTL-S3 Y-Wing. And that came into service for the Alliance as a heavy bomber. And normally it's a two-seater craft, one-person pilots, and the second in the back acts as a gunner and uses a swivel-mounted ion cannons that are located right on top of the cockpit. Now, what we more commonly see in the game is the BTL-A4 variant, which is a one-man version. So that's why with the title in the game, you know, you're required to shoot forward because there's no gunner for you to help out with your shots. So the Y-Wing first started its production line during the Clone Wars. They looked a little bit different. If you notice the Y-Wings now, they look very bare bones. You can see like all the wiring and all the mechanical parts to it right underneath. The Clone Wars version had a lot more armor. How it is, this was actually kind of touched on Rebels a little bit, is that the Y-Wings that we see during the Civil War, they're stripped of their armor to make it more easier to modify them, work on them, because you never know when the Empire is going to come running in. You need to get the ships out in a hurry. So that's how those were. They were used as heavy bombers, as you see in Rogue One. You know, they did that bombing run. That's what we, our Gold Squadron promo is going to be, a nice shot. And they were just used primarily from Jan Dodonna's Rebel cell. That's another thing from Rebels. They captured them and sent them over to him. And they were used throughout pretty much up to the Battle of Endor, where they kind of got phased out by B-Wings. B-Wings were a little bit faster, a little bit more maneuverable. Yeah, that's our title ship, Gold Squadron of Y-Wing.
Where are those transmissions you intercepted? What have you done with those plans?
So I just want to welcome everyone to my favorite portion where we talk about events. As we know, we have a lot of X-Wing related events coming up. The regional will actually be a weekend of events. We'll have a warm-up tournament Friday night. It's two rounds, February 3rd from 7 to 10 p.m. This event is really for two reasons. A, give people the practice the new ships if they want before the main event. B, give people who can't play in the main event and don't want a really heavy competitive environment just something they can come out, play, and maybe have a shot at some of the cool promos that we're giving away. We have three promos for all of the events. There's the Gold Squadron, Paul LaRue promo, which actually shows the Gold Squadron Y-Wings destroying a Star Destroyer with ion torpedoes, just like in Rogue One. Paul really outdid himself here. I mean, what do you guys think of that card?
It's amazing.
Yeah, ridiculous. And then we also have a dual card with Vader fighting Ahsoka on Mustafar. You can earn these cards by playing in these events. In the main event, Saturday, we will have everyone will get the Darth Vader half of the card and the Gold Squadron promo just for playing. And then on Sunday, we'll have our redemption event. Anyone that plays in that event, it'll be four rounds, a Swiss, with a payout by record. And then everyone also has a shot at some more of those promos.
If you play on Sunday, yeah, that's how you get the Ahsoka half, right?
Basically. So if you play on Saturday, the goal was to have, if people played in two out of the three weekend events, you'll get the set. So if you play on Saturday, you'll get your Gold Squadron promo. You will also get the Vader half of the promo. If you play on Friday night in the warm-up event or on Sunday in the redemption event, you'll get the other half. If you make the top 16, you'll get both. So the rest of our events will be starting that month in February. We have, you know, weekly Armada every Tuesday, weekly League for X-Wing every Wednesday, and weekly Destiny every Friday. And then the second Sunday of the month is Imperial Assault at noon, demo and game day. Third Sunday of each month is Star Wars the Card Game, demo and game day. And then the fourth Sunday of each month is Star Wars Destiny, which we just had our last Destiny event, and it was amazing. We had a ton of players, and I'm really looking forward to some more X-Wing and Destiny action this month, because it's going to be packed with events and great prizes.
Well, I want to thank everybody for listening to episode 19 of the Gold Squadron podcast. We had a great time. I hope you really enjoyed everything we talked about here. If you ever want to get in contact with us, feel free to shoot us a message on our Facebook or send us an email to goldsquadronpodcast@gmail.com. If you could be so kind as to like our Facebook page, that would be great. Or even go a step further and give us a review on iTunes. That would be awesome. Ron, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me as always.
Andrea, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, Dion.
Marcel, thank you, sir.
Knock, knock.
Thanks for joining us, buddy.
And Alex, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Gold Squadron, out.